In 1974, Alexander Solzhenitsyn conducted his first interview since the publication of his unparalleled work, The Gulag Archipelago. In this interview, Solzhenitsyn urged his fellow Russians still under the communist dictatorship, I quote, "Everyone should stop cooperating with the lie, capital L, in the most determined way," he said, "for," quote, "the lie is the pillar of the state." Solzhenitsyn's exhortation, as all who have read his works know, was no mere exercise in theoretical moral reasoning. He had lived through evil of the greatest sort. His haggard eyes and scraggly beard, the stoop of his shoulders and the righteous indignation that he bore, betokened how irreversibly he had been touched by the cooperation of so many in the evil of the Soviet Empire. Cooperating with evil is a problem, and grace-guided virtue only can resolve it. Cooperating with evil is a problem in two ways. It's a puzzle to be resolved, and it is morally problematic most of the time. James F. Keenan, S.J., notes that as a puzzle, cooperation with evil has, quote, "generated a considerable discussion among ethicists, bishops, and administrators of Catholic health care facilities." As morally problematic, cooperation can change the human soul in significant and lasting ways, whether the issue be sublime or mundane. Cooperation touches everyone, from Catholic healthcare administrators to doctors to nurses, from ordinary families to men overtaken by thieves, from a nation to an individual citizen. Here, I would like to consider the nature of cooperation, how to morally evaluate it, and what role virtue plays in all of this. So let's begin by considering the act that one agent may bear upon the act of another agent, especially with respect to cooperation. According to Aquinas, the term cooperation indicates that there are two operations, and therefore two agents, that join together in such a way that a secondary agent performs an act that helps the primary agent achieve a presupposed end. Commanding, therefore, is not cooperation properly speaking, for a commander is the primary formal agent of an act carried out by his subordinate. Likewise, scandal is not cooperation, for properly speaking, a scandalous act is one that leads another to choose sin. The scandalous effects of a person's evil deed could continue for even years after his death. Nor is complicity or serving as an accomplice cooperation in the proper sense. For accomplices are persons both responsible for an action, although they may perform differently within their unitary form. So, for instance, a man and woman who willingly engage in adultery, even though their roles in the single act are distinct, they are equally adulterers. Likewise, two Cartesian philosophers who shoot at each other in a duel, they're not cooperating with one another. They are equal but opposite duelists. An exterior act counts as cooperation and not complicity when it is a specifically distinct act from the primary agent, and Aquinas would say it has its own object. A cooperative act may be joined to the act of a primary agent, but the two acts are essentially not the same. A moral object of an act comprises a physical movement, its material term, and these understood by reason within a certain formality. Any difference of the elements can distinguish one act from another, but it is primarily the relation to reason that distinguishes the object of one act from other similar acts. Consider a nurse who hands a doctor a pair of forceps while he is performing an abortion. They are not equally causes of an abortion. He is the primary efficient cause of the abortion, since it is through his use of the material instruments of the abortion that the killing is made effective. And as he chooses to perform the act, he is the direct formal cause of the act itself. In contrast, a nurse may be a secondary agent that provides help so that the primary agent, the doctor, may accomplish his deed. Here we may note that the object of the nurse's act is assisting a doctor to perform an abortion. Her act could not be accurately described merely as assisting a doctor or handing him forceps. For the object of a given moral act cannot mean a mere process or an event of the merely physical order. And that's quoting John Paul II in Veritatis Splendor 78. The physical movement, of course, is to hand forceps, and the material term is the doctor. In the concrete act, though, these are shaped by her knowledge, and the immediate reason for handing him forceps in this concrete situation is so that he can complete this particular act, to kill a baby in the womb. The goal of assisting the abortion is what makes this act of handing over forceps different from other acts of handing over forceps, such as in bullet removal surgery. Accordingly, even if the nurse intends to direct her act of handing forceps to other ends, such as making a living, making the doctor happy with her, the object of abortion assistance remains. Properly speaking, then, the nurse is not an accomplice in abortion, because she does not perform the abortion itself. Nevertheless, she cooperates with it. But what kind of cooperation is she performing? Here I'd like to consider cooperation as it relates to the internal act of the cooperator. And of course we know the famous definition provided by St. Alphonsus Liguori, Redemptorist. He says that the basic and well-known definition is the following. Cooperation is formal, which concurs with the evil intention of the other. And then he gives us a moral evaluation. This cannot be without sin. In contrast, true material cooperation is that which concurs only with the evil action of the other, aside from the intention of the cooperator. Here, Alphonsus separates the external act from the cooperator's subjective intention. One and the same cooperative act, as I describe it, can be performed materially or formally. So once presented with this definition of Alphonsus, many authors who discuss cooperation quickly like to delineate various kinds of formal and material cooperation. They use distinctions such as immediate and mediate, remote and proximate, and so on. The assumption seems to be that we know what it means to approve or want or intend what another person wants, and so we don't need to dally with the issue. But I would like to linger longer here. Note that St. Alphonsus, when he begins his definition of cooperation, he assumes a present act of an agent. The act has a particular quality. It helps a person. Let's call him bad man. And therefore, when Sidekick is helping bad man, Sidekick's cooperation with bad man is either formal or material, depending on certain conditions. The implication, in line with the thought of Aquinas, is that an act of cooperation possesses its own moral object, that the cooperator can intend to a further end toward which he directs the object. Making explicit these matters in Evangelium Vitae, number 74, John Paul II, a graduate of the Angelicum, defines formal cooperation by taking into account both the object of the cooperative act and the intention of the cooperator. Quote, formal cooperation occurs when an action, either by its very nature or by the form it takes in the concrete action, can be defined as a direct participation in an act against innocent life or a sharing in the immoral intention of the person committing it. Right? So he says it involves either the object of the act or a sharing of the intention. So, to evaluate Sidekick's cooperation, one must take into account both what kind of cooperative act Sidekick is performing, that is, what is the object of his act, and what is Sidekick's intended end for the cooperative act, especially as it relates to bad men. Suppose, then, that doctor is scheduled to perform an abortion, as he usually does on Wednesdays, as a means to supplement his income that pays for his child's college tuition. What college, we don't need to say. Nurse finds abortion repugnant because once, when she was in college, she enjoyed herself at a pro-life rally, and she also wants to, at the same time, despite the repugnance, advance her medical career. Now, by analyzing the moral act of abortion into the various components that I've just described, we can understand the various ends and intentions of both agents. And we can see that nurse would instantiate formal cooperation with doctor in a number of ways. Nurse formally cooperates when she concurs with doctor's intention regarding the material aspect of the object of his act, the finis operis. This is my claim. In this case, nurse would intend that her act would help doctor successfully rip the limbs from an unborn baby. Now, some moral theologians would call this implicit formal cooperation, because the cooperator intends only the primary end of the agent's external act, which is included implicitly in the wrongdoer's intended end for the act. So we can say, in this instance, making money for an abortion includes the intention that the abortion be completed successfully. So let's say that nurse has, she enjoys killing babies. So this is, in this case, she's formally cooperating because she wants this to happen. Next, nurse formally cooperates when she concurs with the doctor's intention regarding the formal object of abortion. Nurse, in this case, would intend that her act would help doctor successfully perform an abortion. She thereby necessarily also intends the material aspect, because the physical acts necessary for an abortion are included within a successful abortion taking place. This, too, is implicit formal cooperation. Next, nurse formally cooperates when she concurs with the doctor's intention, that is, his desired end for the act, the finis operantis. In this case, nurse would intend that the doctor receive money for performing an abortion. Her intention necessarily includes the successful completion of the abortion for whoever intends the per se or necessary or even merely typical effect of an action also intends the action. Now, this counts as explicit formal cooperation and often manifests itself not only in cooperating with the act, but some sort of verbal expression of approval of the immoral act. And then finally, we can say that nurse formally cooperates when she concurs with doctor's intention to enjoy an effect that typically occurs after the successful completion of that act. And so in this case, nurse might intend that doctor could pay for his child's college tuition by killing babies. Now, maybe she doesn't think about the killing babies part, but if she knows that the way he has money to pay for the college tuition is by being an abortion doctor, because this is supplementing his income, and she wants him to be able to send his children to college, and there's no other way to send them to college except for these abortive acts on Wednesday, then she intends that too. Notice then that formal cooperation, according to this analysis, has a much wider scope than is often acknowledged. Because even what can seem to be a remote intention, such as desiring that a doctor have money to send his children to college, can in these concrete circumstances constitute formal cooperation, insofar as the intention forms that act of cooperating and all the acts that include it. So additionally, I can also note that those who formally cooperate, and it's not merely formal cooperation is not merely a vague sort of acceptance or approval of an act. Because someone can say, well, she didn't approve of the act insofar as she found it repugnant and distasteful and she doesn't like these things. But nevertheless, we can see that because of the object of her act or because of the various ends that she intends for the act, that despite some sort of emotional repugnance, her will is still engaged in the act. Now, for further circumstances to the situation, such as serious peer pressure on the nurse or financial distress or further intention of helping a mother in need, these would not change the essential structure of the act of killing. Even if cooperation were more understandable to an outsider, or perhaps garnered sympathy or even lowered her willingness to participate in the act, if she chose it, it's voluntary. Now we have to turn to material cooperation. And I'll just remind ourselves of Alphonsus's definition, He says, true material cooperation is that which concurs only with the evil action of the other, aside from the intention of the cooperator. Now let's look at this in light of John Paul II's definition of formal cooperation. First, we find that a person who materially cooperates with another, quote, concurs with the action of the other. This sort of concurrence regards the action, not the further end intended by either agent. And so material cooperation is primarily evaluated with respect to the object of the act that he or she performs, not with respect to their intention, and not with respect to some other good that may accrue incidentally. This is because material cooperation is nested within formal cooperation in the image that a speaker has used, like dolls within dolls that you find in Russia. This is because material cooperation, then, is something that itself can be directed to a further end, but it has its own moral integrity that we can identify. We can recognize it. And so, then, to know what this is, we, in a certain way, can bracket these secondary intentions. And therefore, it follows that merely material cooperation in evil is an act helping a primary agent to perform his evil act such that the cooperator does not concur with that intention in any way. Now, material cooperation then does not concur with an evil intention, but in a certain way it concurs with the evil action. Not through some concurrence or agreement or intention of the end, as I've said, but through a concurrence of action. The action of the cooperator literally runs alongside that of the wrongdoer, but it's not the same act, because otherwise it would be complicity or some other sharing of the act itself. So therefore, once again, it has to have its own moral integrity identified by the object. Sidekick may be helping bad man, but they're doing different things. As Joseph Parkinson explains, in material cooperation, the cooperator's act, if considered in itself, has its own moral object. And this moral object, then, is used, or rather abused, by the evil agent. He uses these means or goods or services for his own wicked end. Now, let's move to, then, morally evaluating cooperation with evil. With all of this in mind, I would like to once again return to the suggestions of Jesuit theologian James Keenan. He argues that cooperation can be, quote, a means of determining whether potential catastrophes can be averted. He gives the example of what he calls classic, which is legitimate in his mind. He says it's the example of the belt-offering wife of a husband intent on beating his children with a baseball bat. He writes, not participating in the moral evil, she cooperates to diminish the physical effects of his illicit action. And then he lists other actions that he thinks are included within this rubric. Legitimate cooperation. He says this includes priests distributing communion to unworthy recipients. This is written in the 90s. Doctors working in clinics that instruct patients about contraception. And what he calls nurses assisting in illicit operations. And then he gives another. This is urging HIV-positive patients who refuse to be chaste to use a condom for the sake of the common good. Now, unfortunately, Keenan's analysis of cooperation oversimplifies the nature of the human act, and it leads to errors regarding an evaluation. For instance, it's not obvious at all that a nurse directly assisting in an illicit operation such as an abortion ever counts as material cooperation. As I've just noted, there are four different ways, at least, that she can formally cooperate in directly assisting in the act while having some repugnance or not intending the same end. But as long as the object is the same, it's not material, it's formal. And then there's the issue of the mother who offers her abusive husband a belt so that he will avoid using the intended baseball bat to bash his children. Keenan's argument seems to be that a mother's act counts as merely material cooperation, not formal, and that it's legitimized on account of her intention to avert the physical effects of this evil. Horrific as it may be, however, accounts in the news indicate that there are instances in which a wife might redirect a husband's violent act to minimize its physical effects and yet still intend it in some way. For example, She might wish to reduce the physical effects of bat bashing, not because she thinks that beating a child is evil, but because she wants her husband to avoid jail time. Or perhaps she's cruel and thinks that the belt will hurt her child more. Or perhaps the mother could offer the belt because, in more precise language, she wants to avoid the material object of the husband's act, blunt trauma, while nevertheless handing him the belt because she shares the husband's intention of the formal object, violence. Or she can share his desired end, to cruelly punish the children. Or even a necessary secondary effect, to make the children fear their parents by traumatizing them. And so simply to describe an act as morally legitimate because she's trying to avoid a greater evil, and so she hands him the belt, this is an insufficient recognition of what's happening in the event in the concrete circumstances. And therefore, we can say that these scenarios, even if they're contrary to the gestalt of Keenan's example, point to the fact that in order to morally analyze cooperation, we have to know what are the circumstances relevant to the situation and what is the object of the act being performed. And further, what are the intentions for that object once performed? Now, of course, in contrast to situations of formal cooperation or causing the moral downfall of another through counsel or persuasion, Aquinas, he says that it is morally licit to make use of another's sin to a good end. And in this case, he indicates that doing so sometimes even imitates God. This relates to a question that arose earlier. Because as Augustine observes in his Enchiridion, the omnipotent God would not allow sin and evil unless by his supreme and omnipotent goodness he could bring forth good from evil. And therefore, just as Christ brought good out of evil from the felix culpa of Adam, so sometimes this is morally licit for us as well. The example that Aquinas provides is in the case of what he calls intrinsically evil, or in se malum, usury. He says it would be completely illicit ever to induce somebody to lend at usury. However, he says there are times in which knowing that the other person is going to loan at usury, one can make use of the good and one can make use of the evil of the other person's lending. He says, and so in this case, it's licit to borrow under usury from a man who is ready to do so and practices usury for the sake of some good, which is the assistance of the borrower's need or that of another. Now, I can't get into all of the conditions in which making use of another's sin is morally licit, but I'll just sort of list them, and perhaps we can talk about this later on. There are three that I counted, three sort of conditions implicit in this example. The first is that the primary potential agent of wrongdoing, so the usurer, he's ready to do it. St. Alphonsus uses even stronger language. He speaks of a person who's not only ready to do evil, but is willfully determined to do it. He cannot be persuaded to cease doing this evil. The second condition is that this would-be wrongdoer must manifest that he's ready to do this particular evil. And the evidence that Aquinas proposes is that this would-be evildoer, you can cooperate with him when he manifests that this is what he's going to do. How does he manifest it? If he's a habitual evildoer of this particular sort. In other words, he practices usury. And then the third condition regards the state of the potential cooperator. He can only perform an act that is good in itself and intended for a good end. Now, this bears some relation to the issues regarding double effect, but of course, this is a slightly different case because this is making use of somebody else's bad action, not oneself performing an action that has two effects. So in this case, then, we can say that one allows someone else to commit a sin, and in doing so, the effect of their sin one uses for some other good purpose. But that good purpose is not intrinsically linked to the sin itself. It's merely tolerating the evil while making use of some side effects. Now, later tradition, in trying to weigh these matters and saying when is it reasonable to tolerate somebody else's sin and make use of it and so on, they began to describe this sort of material cooperation by saying that a person must have a, quote, sufficiently or, quote, proportionally grave reason in order to justify material cooperation in evil. Unfortunately, some authors came to see a proportionate reason for acting as the sole condition for materially cooperating with evil, or even for committing evil directly. And so long as you found the other evil repugnant, well, you could go ahead and cooperate with it. Here is where virtue comes into play. Because whereas later moral theologians came to discuss cooperation with evil primarily by trying to list the various rules of what counts as proportionate and disproportionate, and what conditions can a person in various levels of distress or duress allow themselves to cooperate in such a way as to protect a various good, what I would like to do is sort of move around these and discuss very briefly the issues of virtue, not only justice and charity, but prudence. Justice. Typically, when cooperation with evil was classically discussed, as in the case of Aquinas, it was around the issue of restitution. Justice, in this case, shows that if one is a cause of another's downfall, or if one is a cause of another's experiencing of evil, one is required to restore justice. This is very often overlooked in all discussions of cooperation with evil. Typically, we're looking at the individual who may be cooperating, and we're trying to see whether or not he's exculpated or he's guilty. But we don't see what is the secondary consequence when his action is something that negatively influences another. Likewise, in the realm of justice, I think that we can agree that it's simply insipid to argue that I was just doing my duty somehow excuses one from moral culpability. Whether or not the situation is as grave as Eichmann, a classic bureaucrat, cooperating with Hitler, uses this as an excuse to exterminate the Jews. Now, when we consider, then, the relation of justice to a potentially wronged party, this can, as I said, focus on the intention of the potential cooperator, a servant who holds a ladder for the master, and he may ascend to a virgin's room. Often the question is, what is he doing, and can he do it or not? And very rarely do we ask, what about the virgin? Notice that this kind of situation is more tragic than the mere loss of property for her. You see, there's some goods that, by their nature, are irreplaceable. Once virginity or one's life is lost, no sort of restitution can replace them. And consequently, a potential cooperator doing this kind of act, depending how close he is to performing this act, should reflect and consider not only proportionate reasons for himself, but also consider the other and say to himself, I owe it to the vulnerable to protect, defend, and support them as much as possible. For this is true justice, to care for the good of another. Now, of course, the wider scope of justice, not only the issue of irreplaceable goods, it recalls then how to weigh one good in relation to another. And this is quite, of course, controversial, because it would imply that some goods are more good. And here Aquinas brings in what he calls the ordo caritatis, the order of charity, the order in which things ought to be loved. And he says clearly some things ought to be loved more than others. God, for instance, comes first. And therefore, your relation to God comes before all other relations. And here I can't go and try to explain all of Aquinas' reasoning, but what it means is that there are some objects related to an act, and it makes this kind of act more important than another act. And it also means that these kinds of objects ought not to be sacrificed for the other objects that are lower. And so Aquinas gives a series of questions. Should we love God more than our parents, father more than mother, son more than father? His answers are satisfyingly blunt. He says, essentially, that we ought to love in this order God, one's soul, particularly beatitude, and the next, the soul of one's neighbor, and then one's body, and then the body of one's neighbor. And this is going to help us, this ordered relation, know how to deal with these difficult situations when I have to ask myself, well, should I sacrifice my body in order to save this other person's body? Or should I sacrifice perhaps my body in order to help this other person's soul? That's quite a different issue. And when I'm cooperating with somebody else who's performing a grave evil, am I doing this in such a way as to be concerned about this ordered relation of goods? Prominent among discussions of cooperation with evil, of course, and charity is the issue of scandal, which I've already defined. But here I would just like to point out that love for one's neighbor should mean that one should want to avoid cooperating when it means that the other person may be led to sin. You see, if your cooperation with this evildoer is going to lead him to sin in some way, even if you're not formally cooperating, you don't want any part in the act, you don't intend what he intends, you don't have the same moral object, but if your very mode of materially cooperating is going to in some way influence him or change his will to become more fixed upon this evil, then this is a serious consequence such that one should really think about avoiding it. And here I think that the issue of the gravity of a single sin should be reaffirmed. Blessed John Henry Newman tells us, and he reminds us, that the Church, quote, holds that unless she can in her own way do good to souls, it is no use of her to do anything. She holds it would be better for the sun and moon to drop out of heaven and for earth to fail and all the millions who are upon it to die of starvation of the extremest agony, so far as temporal affliction goes, than that one soul, I say, not only should not be lost, but should commit a single venial sin. And so, when charity considers the wrongdoer, it's also thinking of his soul and cooperating, and how does it affect him? And likewise, it's considered with the souls of potential witnesses. And in these days of the digital world, which affords innumerable opportunities to be fascinated by the evil deeds of others, we have to be concerned of being an exemplar cause of evil. And of course, in charity, we should concern our own soul. Because properly speaking, although we can't scandalize ourselves and we can't be just to ourselves, nevertheless, we should have a proper self-love. And therefore, when we're considering whether or not to cooperate with a particular evil, we have to be very honest about our own proclivities. Because Aquinas says, very reasonably, he says, the weak should avoid associating with sinners on account of the danger which they have of being perverted by them. He says, however, it's commendable for the perfect, who have no fear of falling, to associate themselves with sinners that they may convert them. And so we have to say then that sometimes we should avoid even material cooperation because it may ensnare us in evil. A man baby buying Budweiser for his drunk-loving buddies might be becoming a booze runner for his boy's biweekly beer bash. It's something to avoid. And finally, the issue of prudence will help us to judge rightly the situations that call for our cooperation. Dominicans friars John McHugh and Charles Callan, associated with this venerable institution, they give us an honest assessment of the task. They say, the application of the definitions and rules about cooperation in particular cases is one of the most difficult tasks of moral theology. And hence, they admit, there will be great diversity of opinion among theologians on particular points. They implicitly acknowledge that the typical route in manualist-driven analyses of cooperation was to deliberate about the issue by comparing and weighing rules and definitions. They're trying to establish a course of action that has the greatest probability of being morally licit. In other words, the issue and the judgments of virtue were often cast aside. Issues about legitimate or illegitimate cooperation, of course, bears an analogy to the ways economists attempt to mathematically formulate the optimization of a complex decision process. Andrew Jungert's research on this is particularly salient because he's shown that current economic models will fail to produce an accurate result regarding optimal choice without prudence. For deliberation about optimal human acts is often more than adding relevant data to a complex algorithm in order to crunch a relevant result. The result of a rule-based method of deliberation is that a potential cooperator faces, well, a complex issue that he cannot in the present moment think through. It's irresolvable, and so he's mired in a difficulty and he ends up lying on moral intuitionism. Whereas in contrast, one acting prudently takes counsel about how to achieve and preserve the good ends he intends. He judges about various objects as means, and then he chooses those means in a concrete act. And this is why prudence, as the inclination of the mind toward the good recognized as true, is going to then be influenced both by his passions and by his past and by the counsel he's received from others. And here I think that Germain Griset has something very helpful to say. In his appendix to volume 3 of his work, The Way of the Lord Jesus, he gives an analysis of formal and material cooperation. And there's a paragraph there that has struck me for years. And he says this: if material cooperation is ongoing or becomes a regular practice, it is likely to have much graver consequences than an isolated act. Performance, he says, especially repeated performance, tends to become habitual. Interaction with wrongdoers tends to generate psychological bonds in their interdependence. And therefore, cooperation often leads to opportunities and temptations to engage in further cooperation. And I think he's completely right. That very often when we consider material cooperation or when we consider formal cooperation, we're trying to evaluate the issue, we're thinking of a single act. And we're not seeing this act within the timeline of an entire person's life. We're not looking at his own individual inclinations. We're not seeing how this is going to have perhaps ripple effects in the future. And if he's getting the beer from his booze buddies, well, how is that going to influence his long-term success in college and in life? And I think this is one of the chief reasons why Scripture, sacred Scripture, continually exhorts us not only to avoid committing evil, it tells us to avoid evildoers. This is a theme throughout, and it's astonishing how much you can find it. Psalm 1 declares blessed the person not merely who does not commit sin, but the one who walks not in the counsel of the wicked, who stands not in the way of sinners. Proverbs commands, do not enter the path of the wicked, and do not walk in the way of evil men. Avoid it. It asks, can a man take fire in his bosom and his clothes not be burned? And then Sirach responsibly answers, well, he that touches pitch shall be defiled. St. Paul tells the early Christians to avoid those who create dissensions. He says, do not associate with immoral men. Do not associate with idolaters and revelers and drunkards and robbers. He says, keep away from any brother, this is a quote, who is living in idleness and not in accord with tradition. And so these principles of virtue, this understanding of the nature of the human act, helps us then to understand ourselves and the nature of the world and the direction of the church in separating herself from the world and yet helping the world when she can. Because we know that we are to do good for our neighbors and not evil, and we ultimately to overcome evil with good. Now, when Alexander Solzhenitsyn urges his fellow citizens not to cooperate, but to resist, this is not merely because he had suffered from the evils. If you read the Gulag very carefully, he cooperated with the evils. He himself was morally complicit in the downfall of many of his fellow men. And this was something that always strained at him, something that touched him deeply. And I believe this twisted him, but also when he came out of this and he repented, he could see that this cooperation was something that wasn't just in him. It was endemic in this kind of society. And therefore, he's not simply telling others to avoid evil. He's reminding himself of the evil he performed. And he's recalling, perhaps, the same insight as John Paul II. Quote, it is always possible that man, as a result of coercion or other circumstances, can be hindered from doing certain good, but he can never be hindered from not performing certain actions, especially if he is prepared to die rather than to do evil. And therefore, our preparedness not to cooperate with evil should serve as the basis of every proper discernment for actually cooperating. Because, as James Shaw reminds us, when we reject the validity of Socrates' refusal to cooperate with evil, the very foundation of our civilization is gone. Thank you.
Just a couple of clarifications. So the commander subordinate, you said, wouldn't be a case of material cooperation or just cooperation.
When a commander commands a subordinate to perform an act, he's the primary formal agent. And so he actually, he's not cooperating with his subordinate. He's causing his subordinate to do it.
Right, but if the subordinate cooperates or no?
Well, no. If the subordinate is following the commander's action, he's performing the action. He's just performing it in a secondary way.
Because I'm thinking of Monsignor Cummings' example yesterday of the ladder holder. Would that be a subordinate, a commander and a subordinate, or would that be a servant that's actually, as he had it, implicitly, formally cooperating in the violation of a woman?
Right. So the issue I'm thinking of is a commander who, say, sits in his office and he writes an order that should be performed. He's not actually performing an act. He's commanding. Whereas the master, in the case of the master in the ladder, he's actually performing an act. He's climbing the ladder. He's entering the window. He's doing something. And so in this case, you have two actions, the master and the servant. And the question is, how is the servant, his own action, related to the action of the master? And then we can walk through whether or not that's formal and material, depending on the closeness of the act and the intention and so on.
Okay, thank you. And then also the joint, the per se connection versus and to even simple outcome between the act and then the principal actor's intention. So would you, are those all it seems to me like you could find room between, go back to the ladder holder, his intention just to pull the ladder and thereby preserve his life or save his, you know, his job and the actual attack on a woman. But as Monsignor said yesterday, he said, because that's a typical outcome, that he would have to cooperate formally with that. Do you join those, consider those pretty close, or are those...
Okay, yeah, good question. So I would actually distinguish, I would not quite agree with Monsignor, because I would say that the object of the servant's holding the ladder, he at least wants to intend that the master successfully get up the ladder, right? Because if somehow the matter slips because the servant wasn't holding it well, or if the if he was distracted and the ladder got shaky or something like that, then you can say that he didn't fulfill what the object of the act was. However, the object of the act of holding the ladder as such does not include what happens after the master gets off the ladder. And so those count not as typical effects of holding a ladder, because a ladder has nothing to do with whatever happens inside the room, per se. Rather, they're ordered by the end of the master. And so in this case, you can say that the end of the ladder holder, the servant, he doesn't share the same end, and therefore the object of the act is good, to hold a ladder. His intention is different, and therefore it's material cooperation.
How about the nurse with the forceps? Because there are handing forceps typically that... Is that per se connected, or is that typically resulting in being an abortion?
Right. So in this case, in the case of the nurse with the forceps, her handing over the forceps it's true that it's a material cooperation insofar as she intends to hand something material over, and this is going to assist the end of the act. However, she can't hand over the forceps in such a way as to intend something other than an abortion be performed in that case. Whereas, as people pointed out yesterday in the response, question and answer response with Monsignor Cummings, the ladder holder, he could still hope that the master convert after he get off the ladder, or that something else happened once he entered the room. So it seems to me that these are two slightly different cases.
Thank you.
No?
Thank you for your presentation. It was very, very helpful. I have one question about Dr. Grisey and his work on cooperation. He seemed to minimize the importance of physical proximity. One of the conditions that Alphonsus lays down for licit material cooperation is that there must be some degree of remoteness, physical and causality, to the performance of the act. But Dr. Grisey thinks that that is... physical proximity as such is irrelevant. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't want to analyze Dr. Grisey's approach. It's complex, but I do think that material, actual physical proximity is very important. And you can say, for instance, if we're going to go back to the issue of how does handing forceps, how is that distinct from climbing the ladder? The forceps themselves are the very instrument by which the abortion is performed. So the act of killing the baby uses the forceps, whereas the master is not using the latter as such to do anything. It's an instrument beyond which he goes in order to do something else. And so you can say there's actually a physical proximity by the very instrumentality of these two physical things, the latter or the forceps. And so in this case, this is one of my arguments for why these are two distinct kinds of acts. You can't intend something other than an abortion with the forceps in the doctor, in the aborting doctor's hands. That's what he's doing. Whereas a ladder, as I said, he's going beyond the ladder, and it's not as an instrument for the act of violating the virgin.
Okay, I enjoyed your presentation, especially your pun. I want to get back to the commander that issues an order, and going back to your argument with regards to forceps as being the precise implement that does the damage. Within a bureaucratic state, one could argue that the order is the precise instrument that the bureaucracy uses to implement the damage. And so if a commander issues an order to say, move people to a gulag, and a subordinate initiates or follows that order, isn't that the same then as the nurse who then passes the implement?
Okay, so I think here it has to do with an equivocation regarding instrumentality, because literally the order is an intention of the commander that he wants the other person also to intend. The order is not a piece of paper. The order is it's formal causality, that an intention does cause evil. There's no doubt about that. However, the intention is always regarding a means. And so when the commander is commanding someone to put innocent Russians into a train to go to the gulag, the instrumentality of the order is the train. It's the guns that they're using in order to force them in. It's not simply a general intention, right? And so in this case, likewise, with respect to the forceps, in this case, there really is a physical instrumentality there. And so it's true that in a certain respect, you can say that an order is an instrument of evil, but properly speaking, it's a formal cause. It's not a material cause or an efficient cause, per se.
Brother Ezra, can I ask you, what about the nurse who's charged with putting in the IV or monitoring the oxygen during the abortion procedure?
Okay, well, in these cases, it's clear that those physically are not connected directly to the act of abortion. And so some people have argued, well, this is material cooperation. And then this gets into the distinction between proximate and remote material cooperation. And so some would say, okay, well, if this is material cooperation, it's still so close to the act that it's still unreasonable. And you can't say that offering an IV is necessary, absolutely speaking, for the abortion to happen, because the abortion could happen without those. However, they are useful instruments that are being used by the doctor in order to direct them to his primary end.
But I mean, it might not be it might be no more necessary than forceps. I mean, there are many different ways to perform an abortion, and you could do it a compensating different way. But if you're going to put the patient under anesthesia, you need the oxygen or whatever, you know, something like that.
Well, actually, I would
be any different than, like, okay, I'm handing him forceps and I'm hoping he discovers just before he kills the baby that there's some, you know, some danger to some biological abnormality in the womb that means I can't do this abortion today.
Okay, so actually, I would disagree with your premise, and I would say that, in fact, offering an IV never causes abortion. And so, therefore, it's not a material cause in the same way as forceps are. So you really have to understand what is the direct causality of this particular act. And as I said, although it's useful to the act, it's not causing it. It's an adjunct. That's literally why it's a circumstance.
Yeah, this is, of course, fascinating. I wonder if we're not abstracting too greatly from the nature of action here, in the sense that minimally, I mean, it seems to me we take the most minimal formulation. Wouldn't one need to say that it's become the principal condition of the object in the case of the latter, for example? that he's only putting the ladder where it is and holding it there rather than somewhere else because of the enterprise in which his master is involved, to which he is contributing that much. And since the enterprise as designed by his master includes this and the enterprise is wicked, why wouldn't we simply say that this is something he shouldn't do? It seems in its species formally wrong, but it seems as though, I mean, I'm thinking of the anesthesiologist too. In other words, you can perform thought experiments that are rather, you know, you can have an assistant whose job is only to prepare the conditions, say, for someone's laboratory activity. And in one case, they just happen to include the final electrical connections to do a test on how people fare under electrocution. And the final check of the circuits is, of course, no one gets electrified by that. But knowing the nature of the project, I mean, it would say, and calling that material cooperation would share there's a certain risible aspect. So I wonder, I mean, in focusing on the nature of the instrument, rather than on the, as it were, the teleological direction of the project as such, aren't you in danger of introducing a certain artificiality here? You can say no, and then.
No. I mean, I think the gist of these kinds of questions regard how do we define the causality of an act. Ultimately, the real issue is we're not supposed to cause evil. And then we're not supposed to cause things that are always evil. And the question becomes, how do we know when somebody's a cause of the evil or he's a contributor to the evil? And if you're just contributing to it, you're not causing it. And this is why precisely you have the difference between formal and material causality. So what I'm trying to do is be very, very clear about what counts as a cause. And I would say that what counts as a cause includes the intention, because as I said before in my answer to the man who asked about the order, clearly that's a formal cause, but it's not a material cause. Okay, so the issue about, you know, plugging in the electrical, this is whether or not by intending, you know, by plugging in the electrical, are you intending for the person to die? And if you're not, then how is this efficient and material act related to these other acts? And I would say it's not the act per se, because otherwise you're going to, it could go the opposite way, right? Is that everybody who is in some way connected to evil, they're always complicit in the evil in any way. So like there are two kind of poles we want to avoid, as you know. I mean, we want to avoid crass intentionalism, but we also want to avoid a sort of materialism that that says, well, everybody who is in some way related to this act is directly complicit. And so that's what I'm trying to say. Well, if, you know, maybe we're not disagreeing. It's more a question about how do we define when are you a cause and when aren't you a cause?
And thanks, Father Ezra.